This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. They call it, this house, a house in paradise. It's a sprawling estate built by tobacco heiress Doris Duke in Honolulu. She called it Shangri-La, and it's filled with her life's passion, Islamic art. Its work has been shipped halfway around the world, and it spans more than 1,000 years of history. After Doris Duke's death, Shangri-La was open to the public, and now you don't have to go all the way to Hawaii to see what's inside. Doris Duke's Shangri-La, Architecture, Landscape, and Islamic Art, opens tomorrow at the National Museum of Art at Duke University. Deborah Pope is the executive director of Shangri-La and joins us now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
Tell me about Shangri-La in Honolulu.
Well, Shangri-La, as you noted, was Doris Duke's very private home and personal retreat. She built it between 1936 and 1938 on the water just east of Diamond Head. Fabulous site, fabulous views. She worked very closely with the architect, an American architect, Marion Sims Wyeth, to design the estate. She was very involved, very hands-on in the early conception and even construction site visits when she would come to visit. And then she, from the beginning, she really conceived of it as a place in which to house her growing collection of Islamic art. So the house is very much a 1930s early modernist house with all this overlay of Islamic art and architectural ornament that she applied to it. And it houses nearly 60 years of her collecting and installing Islamic art, everything from ceilings, doors, portable objects. So it's quite a remarkable place, and it kind of has this interesting dynamic between this very tropical setting, you know, very dramatic, very early modern house, and then years and years of traditional Islamic art installed in it. It's intriguing.
Tell us about the inspiration for all of this. A 10-month honeymoon. Wouldn't we all like one of those? In some of the most exotic places in the world still today, but certainly then in the late 20s and 30s. Tell us about that honeymoon and what she saw.
She got married when she was 23 and immediately embarked with her husband, James Cromwell, on a round-the-world honeymoon trip, which I think he promised her during the courtship. We know they sailed from New York to Monte Carlo and then from there to Egypt, brief stop, Jordan, and then on to India. And it's in India where, at least in her mind, the lights go on and she finds herself absolutely enchanted by the art and architecture of the Mughal dynasty, who was the last dynasty that ruled India before the British took it over. And it's in particular visits to places like the Taj Mahal and the Red Fort in Delhi, where she just is captivated by that art and architecture. She also has an audience with Gandhi at the time that he is actually living and working and trying to revive traditional crafts in India. And that's obviously one of the topics that they speak about, according to the media coverage of this meeting. And following that meeting, she goes back to Delhi and she hires a British architectural firm and commissions a bedroom and bath suite in the design of Mughal India. The work is all done by Indian craftsmen who are working in Agra, where the Taj Mahal is. And at the time she commissioned it, she planned it for a house they thought they were going to build in Palm Beach. But in the end, it ended up as being the nucleus of the house in Hawaii.
This is fascinating, and it's going to be grist for a much larger conversation as this hour goes on. But we think of India as a predominantly Hindu nation, and if you're talking about the native sort of arts and crafts that Gandhi was trying to revive, we don't think so much of Muslim culture, and yet it was part of a Muslim empire, the Islamic Empire. And these kinds of influences, regional, geographic, as well as religious, all play a part in what we now call Islamic art.
That's exactly right. And in fact, if you were to go to India and you were to interview people who live there and ask them, you know, whose art and architecture is the Taj Mahal? Everyone would claim it as their own. And people often forget that, in fact, it was commissioned by a Muslim in honor of his deceased Muslim wife. But it's really claimed by everyone as their cultural heritage. And it's that wonderful mixing and blending of things. And, you know, I think it's part of the spirit of Shangri-La is that kind of, you know, disinclination to draw sharp lines of identity and that kind of blending that makes it such a such an intriguing and successful place.
So give us an idea about her tastes and what it was she was interested in. What's the range of objects she collected?
Well, it's a pretty wide range. She does not she did not collect like an art museum curator. She collected to suit her own individual tastes. She collected in the early years very much to furnish the home. So she's buying at a very large scale, for example, over 600 Isnik tiles from Turkey to clad the walls of the first room that you walk into when you enter the house. She's also commissioning on a grand scale in India. We talked about the bedroom suite. She's commissioning ceramic tiles that clad the interiors and the exteriors of many spaces throughout the property in Iran in 1938. She's commissioning whole ceilings, walls, doors, windows in Morocco in 1937, and she's doing smaller scale commissions in Damascus also in the 30s in order to flesh out the house. So that interest in commissioning from contemporary artisans is something that kind of distinguishes her as a collector. And then she's collecting across all countries that make up what we think of as the Islamic world, literally from Spain and North Africa in the West, all the way to South Asia and a little bit of Southeast Asia and everything in between. Probably the largest body of material comes from Iran. And then across all media, so textiles, ceramics, wood, some paper, you name it.
So she's doing this, as you say, largely to decorate her house and for her own taste. How does she stack up if you were to put her as an art critic? How would she stack up as a collector in that world and by that standard?
Art critics. Sorry.
We have our answer.
Well, you know, she has the best of the best, and she has things that, and by that I mean she has things that any museum that collects Islamic art, whether they're in the UK or Europe or in the country of origin or in New York City, would kill to have. And she has things that any art museum curator or buyer for Christie's or Sotheby's would walk right past without looking twice at. She has fabulous fine art, what we would consider fine art, and she has more ethnographic collections like you would buy at the bazaar and everything in between. I think she has really good taste and a fabulous eye, and that is what struck me the most when I first walked in the door and saw that place in the summer of 2000. So she's not without taste, but she's doesn't think and she didn't collect like an art museum curator, and I don't think she ever intended to.
And she designed a house she wanted to live in. It is now a museum in which these artifacts are located and collected. What is the space? What are those pieces like in that space? How do they work together?
Well, that's the most remarkable part is when you describe it. It sounds like it could be a hodgepodge and a bit of a mishmash, but it's not. And I think one of the reasons, I think there are a couple of reasons why it's not. One is that there is certain visual vocabulary that is shared across most, if not all, Islamic cultures. And so things tend to go together fairly cohesively. And I think the second piece of it, you know, is her eye and her the extent to which her travels helped her understand the context in which these things were used and displayed and in which they occur. And in many places, she's able to, if not recreate, at least suggest and give you enough of the ambiance. So that when you walk into the central patio, where everything in there is from Iran, you feel like you're in Isfahan, which I've never been, but I've been with people who are from Isfahan, and they're like, oh, I'm at home, you know.
What's it like for this exhibit, for these pieces to be out of their home now and on the road? And is this something Doris Duke wanted to get these pieces out to a larger public?
You know, one of the things she put in her will is open the place up, make it available to scholars. I mean, she has that language right in there, and to the general public. And I think she understood that a lot of what she had was of artistically significant enough that it deserves scholarly study and examination. And she, it's not something that she encouraged or provided access to during her lifetime because she was so fiercely private, but she knew it was important. So I think she'd be delighted that this stuff was on the road and more accessible. And a lot of what we do is all about providing access on our website, through our database, et cetera.
Now at the Nasher at Duke, we'll talk more about Doris Duke's Shangri-La collection as our conversation continues. We'll talk, too, about Islamic art and culture and its influence on the West. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Doris Duke's Shangri-La, Architecture, Landscape, and Islamic Art opens tomorrow at the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University. Deborah Pope is the executive director of Shangri-La. We thought we'd delve a little deeper right now into Islamic art and culture. So we're joined by Miriam Cook, who is a professor of Arab culture at Duke University, and Imam Abdullah Antepli is the Muslim chaplain at Duke University. Welcome to both of you. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having us.
Miriam Cook, how common was collecting Islamic art during Doris Duke's time?
I think it was very uncommon, particularly in America. Though, of course, we have to remember that this period, so the 20s and 30s, was a time when wealthy men, in particular, were putting together huge collections. So there was, of course, the Freer and Sackler museums emerged out of private Islamic art collections. So she was not the only one, but unusual in that she was the only woman that we know of to have such an extraordinary collection.
And we should really talk about what it is we're saying when we use a phrase like Islamic art. We pointed to it when we talked about the Taj Mahal. What do we mean? What do you mean when you hear that?
What a great question. Yes, this is something that I think will be talked about at Duke during the panel that will be held at the Nasher on the 26th of September. And that is the question that has been much debated. Is it the religion? So is it the religion of the artist? Is it his or her subject? Is it the religion of the patron? Is it the religion of the place where the art is produced? So I think what we have to do is to try and move away from this notion that it is in any way religious, but rather to use a term that Marshall Hodgson, a very important historian of the 20th century, a term that he used, which is Islamicate. And that is the culture, the artistic production of a place that has had Islam in some way part of its history.
And Abdullah Antepli, I know you wanted to talk about this as well in terms of the influence of the religion and the confluence of time and space as well.
I totally agree with Miriam that to think Islamic art as just the sheer product of Islamic theology or religious imagination would be such a reductionist and simplistic way of looking at this civilizational depth and richness that you will see at this exhibition. And also, all these Islamic art was produced by Muslim societies which were not monolithic. It was multicultural, multilingual, as well as multireligious. So anything Turkish, Persian is also partially Greek and Armenian and Greek Orthodox. Anything Mughal is both Muslim as well as Hindu, Sikh, and other communities as well. Until and unless we pay attention to these nuances, I think it'll be very, as I said, narrow way of looking at this. We will miss the opportunity through these artifacts, use them as a window to see the rich history and civilizational richness behind them.
Well, what do you think it meant to Doris Duke, and what was it that she saw or felt? What was it she would see in a piece that says, that's part of this collection, whatever she may have called it? Deborah?
Oh, that seems like a simple question, but it's actually complicated. You know, I think in the end, she's buying for aesthetics. Mm-hmm. But because of her travels and because of her study, she recognizes, you know, the commonalities. And so she can walk into a gallery and look at a lustreware platter that's made in Spain and know that it's got, you know, a Christian cross on it, but recognizes that, in fact, it's made in Andalusia in Spain, you know, about 100 years after the last Muslims have stopped ruling, but probably by a Muslim craftsman, mm-hmm. with these Muslim motifs, but for a Christian patron. And she would recognize that and understand how it fit within the collection and be attracted to it.
Well, Miriam Cook, is there an aesthetic tie that binds all of these works or any way in which they could be identified?
Well, I think that goes back to the question of history and the way in which the Islamic Empire in the 7th century spread so swiftly across the world, reaching China and Spain from the Arabian Peninsula in less than 100 years. And in this very swift move across the world, picking up local artistic cultural traditions, integrating them, improvising, and in the process bringing together differences in a way that I think to us today spells Islamic. Though I think it is important also to note that Islamic art is a term that some people use and some don't. Some will say, well, as Deborah has just said, well, this was Persian art or this was Spanish art that is given the title Islamic. But in fact, what we have is a very dynamic tradition of improvisation and adaptation. And so what does come out as recognizable is the floral motifs, the geometric that are said to indicate infinity, the disapproval, though not the prohibition, of representation of figures and of animals and human beings. But in so-called Islamic art, particularly from the Mughal period that you, Deborah, were talking about, the 16th, 17th century, when the Taj Mahal was being built, there were many, many, many miniatures that not only represented the rulers, but also daily life. So there is something, maybe the colors even, mm-hmm. between Turkish ceramics, the Isnik tiles in Shangri-La, and the connection with the Isfahan tiles that you were talking about, there is a kind of blue turquoise that people immediately resonate to.
I want to get back, too, to this idea of the way in which religious ideas may have influenced this art. Mm-hmm. Miriam talking about the disapproval of images. And this leads to some fairly elaborate calligraphy. And so tell us more about that, mm-hmm. Abdullah.
Absolutely. just to complete my previous answer, even though these arts were produced in the multicultural, multi-religious societies, of course, it's absolutely also true that one of the driving force and motivation was the Islamic theology, Islamic religious imagination. This art was deeply rooted in Islamic understanding of world and the divine and the everything in between. So many of the manifestations of these arts were trying to capture the religious and spiritual imagination of the Muslim societies. And for many believing, practicing Muslims who were involved, it was an act of worship. It was a spiritual practice. One of the prime examples of that is the calligraphy. In the context of not being able to create images, of course, that did not stop Muslim society's geniusness and artistic flow of producing something which will capture who they are and who they worship and who they love and fear. And this was calligraphy became an important tool of Muslim, a channel of Muslim imagination outpouring itself in the form of writing words, because God revealed God's self in the form of words in all Abrahamic traditions. So words is important. The revelation is important. So in the absence of not being able to draw images, Muslims were able to create and produce different kinds of images by writing, by the beauty of Arabic calligraphy, by the beauty of Arabic alphabet. They were able to take the love and passion and their relationship with the divine and manifest itself in the form of words. And this calligraphy became an important mark of identity. Muslims took pride in developing these artistic styles of writing Arabic words and the Quranic scriptures in many different ways, that every society, every Muslim culture have developed their own unique ways of improving their calligraphy.
And maybe this speaks to why it's true that the Quran is not a Quran unless it's written in Arabic.
Absolutely.
And so this is that the artifact itself is the message. You can't really separate the two and translate.
Right.
So, Deborah, let me ask you about this. How interested was Doris Duke in all of these cultural ideas? Is this something she studied and was interested in as well as the artifacts themselves?
You know, I think she's very interested in the people and the cultures of the Islamic world. There's no evidence to suggest that she explored or was a practitioner of Islam. And, you know, I hesitate to say that she is an intellectual. You know, I think she's more of, you know, she's an aesthetic person. She was a, you know, a dancer, a singer, a performer. She's more kinetic than she is intellectual.
Did she prefer one medium over another, one kind of art over another?
Well, the you know, what she has most of in the collection is actually ceramics, more ceramic tiles and ceramic portable vessels probably than anything else. But, you know, as I mentioned earlier, she did commission on a grand scale, not just ceramics, but coffered wood ceilings from Morocco and Syrian tile fountains. And she, you know, acquired two entire interiors from 19th century Damascus, painted wood interiors. So her, you know, her interests were quite eclectic.
We talked about the eclectic nature and the fact that many cultures come together in the art that we call Islamic. What is the influence, or is there an influence of Islamic art on what we would call Western art? Miriam? Is there a direct influence in that way, or and we'll talk about it in the other direction, and whether there's a contemporary movement as well, because we're talking about traditional art, but what's going on today in the what we would call the Islamic world?
Yes. I think that there has been a tendency on the part of more traditional Islamic art scholars to think of Islamic art as history. And so it stopped in the 19th century, and what we have now is regional, national production. And I have a very interesting example of this from Doha, Qatar. In 2008, the wonderful Ayanpei Museum was opened in an instant island, on an instant island in Doha. And so there is a priceless collection of objects, like the historical objects in Doris Duke's collection. And then downstairs, the temporary opening exhibit was by an Indian Muslim called M.F. Hussain. Now, some of the Islamic art specialists who came were shocked. What did this have to do with Islamic art? This wasn't Islamic art. And then the question is, in what way could this possibly not be Islamic art? He's a Muslim. Sheikh Hamza, the wife of the emir of the time, Muslim. It was in a Muslim country. And above all, it was a commission. He, at the age of 93, committed to painting 99 paintings that were inspired by Islamic theology. And by the time that the exhibition opened, there were over 25 paintings that were part of this series of 99, and what is 99 in Islam, but the 99 names of God. So we have this extraordinary situation where, because it's after the 19th century or the middle of the 20th, it somehow no longer is Islamic art.
But when you sense the influence of the spread of this amazing civilization over that swath of earth, that influence is felt in so many ways that, you know, you can choose to call it Islamic or not, but you can't all ignore the influence of that remarkable civilization.
Absolutely. And there is a troubling tendency, I think, globally in every society to teach history, civilization in silos. And in the West, we have a very common tendency to teach our children and learn our history in a very Eurocentric, Western-centric way, as if European enlightenment, industrialization, and modernity happened in a vacuum. Everything started in Europe with no external influence, with no engagement with the rest of the world, as if somehow the disconnect between the Greek philosophy after 500-600 years later resurrected itself in a miraculous way, and the Europeans from Dark Ages, they jump into the modern age. You know, life doesn't work that way. The human civilization is produced and improved in connection, in engagement with other civilizations as well. It is rather very painful to see and read history books in the West with no acknowledgement of Muslim civilizations, Muslim arts, Muslim philosophies' influence at the beginning of the European Enlightenment.
You should remind us of some of the intellectual achievements that have worked their way into American or Western science and culture.
Absolutely. I mean, Muslim civilizations, like every other civilizations, they had their civilizational rise and civilizational declines. And when Muslim civilizations were experiencing their civilizational rise and experiencing golden ages of the 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th centuries, and later on with the Ottoman Empire, Mughal Empire, and the Safavid Empire of the 14th, 15th century, most of the scientific and technological inventions of today in math, physics, chemistry, most of the astrological advancement, it has its deep debt and gratitude to early Muslim philosophers' ability to translate Greek philosophy, Aristotle, Plato, and the earlier Roman scientists into Arabic first and then improve it. Like, example, Biruni, the guy invented algebra. We are very much in debt of like these Muslim scientists of the 10th, 11th centuries with the inventions which then spark all the scientific and technological advancement that we enjoy today.
Not to mention zero.
Yes.
Which is to say thanks for nothing.
Exactly.
I'm sorry. I just had to get it in. The joke is rattling about in your mind and you think, how do I get it out?
But that's very appropriate.
And how good. Well, how about this exhibit and its contribution? Let me start with you, Deborah, but I'll ask you, Imam and Teple, sort of its contribution to this dialogue and this better understanding of these worlds and how they, in fact, feed each other and influence each other.
Well, I hope that it's apparent to people who visit. You know, I mean, Doris Duke, as a 23-year-old young American woman traveling, falling in love with the so-called Islamic world and its art and culture, collecting it, creating this amazing place. So you have that story as kind of the narrative of the show. You also have the integration of wonderful archives, some from Shangri-La, some from here at Duke University, and you have the integration of contemporary work made by living artists who are in residence at Shangri-La responding to what she did there, responding to what's going on in the world today, what's going on in their countries of origin. So you know, it is a show that tries to capture what I think is the best of Shangri-La, which is this desire not to put things into little boxes, but to really weave things together and to look at the larger narrative. And ideally, for most Americans who I don't think have a very advanced understanding of Muslim culture or Islam, it's a point of entry. You know, it's an attractive and beautiful and fairly easy point of entry to larger conversations.
And Abdullah, how exquisite is it that it's our own, Durham's own Doris Duke who brings this back to us?
It is absolutely beautiful. And as I totally agree with Deborah that it will be an entry point, a window of opportunity to see Islamic theology, Muslim history, and Muslim engagement with the West. I think in many ways, providentially, Doris Duke prepared this for post-9/11 American society. And many, it's no secret that neither Muslims in the United States nor America at large were ready with the 9/11 and the post-9/11 challenges it brought. Since then, it has been a homework and a struggle of American society to understand Islam as a religion and Muslims as people. And the country is very much divided over these issues. For the last 10, 11, 12 years, for the last 5 years here at Duke, I spent significant amount of my time, like many Muslims, telling people who we are not, what we are not, etc. So I think this exhibition will be an opportunity to tell people who we are and what we are. Bible says you will get to know them through their fruits. And what better ways than explaining what Islam is, who Muslims are, other than their art and their art exhibition.
I want to thank you all for being on the program. Doris Duke, Shangri-La, Architecture, Landscape, and Islamic Art opens tomorrow at the Nasher at Duke University. More about Doris Duke in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio. We've been talking this hour about Doris Duke's interest in Islamic art. Now I want to take a look at her life. She lived in the public eye. Media documented her fortune, her lovers, and her clothing. But who was she? Bridget Boer is associate editor of Duke Magazine and a Doris Duke researcher, and she joins us now. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us more about this family that Doris Duke was born into. We've heard the name around here. I know it's a very familiar name.
Right. So Doris Duke's grandfather was Washington Duke, who was born in what was then Orange County. And when he came back from the Civil War, he was essentially a poor tobacco farmer. He planted some tobacco and grew that into what became American Tobacco. Now, that was really at the hard work of his two sons, Ben Duke and James B. Duke. James B. Duke, Buck Duke, was Doris Duke's father. By the time she was born in 1912, American Tobacco was a huge multinational global corporation, and they'd also branched into hydroelectric power, founding what is now Duke Power. So whereas Washington Duke was a poor tobacco farmer, his granddaughter Doris was born into great luxury and wealth. She was born in New York and grew up across from the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So she was exposed to art at an early age, learned French at an early age, and really was immersed in everything that money could buy.
So was she a Southern girl? I mean, was she part of this or a cosmopolitan woman almost from birth?
I think of her as a very cosmopolitan woman, a very international traveler. She liked to travel throughout her life. She did maintain some roots in the South. She had three houses, Shangri-La being one of them. Duke Farms was really sort of a tribute to her father. So her father eventually bought what would become 2,200 acres to form Duke Farms. And I think it was modeled sort of in the farms of his youth. So Doris became very interested in crop rotations. There was actually efforts during World War II to supply corn and oats and rye. So that was a place where she could roll up her sleeves and be sort of the farmer's daughter, if you were. But she also, like she did at Shangri-La, she had projects at each of the three houses that she owned where she completely immersed herself in those projects and was very hands-on in their design and execution.
What was her relationship with her money? Was she philanthropic? Was she acquisitive? I mean, what kind of a woman was she with respect to that money?
Right. So her father died when she was a month shy of her 13th birthday. When he established the Duke Endowment, he also established the Doris Duke Trust for her. When he died, she inherited what would eventually amount to $80 million paid out in three parcels, roughly equivalent to $1 billion in today's money. She was very much aware of business and philanthropy from an early age. She would go sit on her father's lap during business meetings. He showed her what it meant to run an international company. So when she turned 13 and was on her own, between the ages of 13 and 15, she actually acquired both Duke Farms and Rough Point, the family's home in Newport, Rhode Island, from her mother in a friendly lawsuit, buying each for a dollar, and then oversaw them for the rest of her life. Philanthropy was a very big part of her life. She established her first foundation at the age of 21 and continued to be philanthropically inclined throughout her life. I think it's estimated that by the end of her life, she'd given away more than $400 million. Yeah. She paid very close attention to her money.
What were the kinds of things she was interested in her
philanthropy? Early on, she echoed a lot of the philanthropic interests of her family, so education, social welfare for women and children. But she was also a little bit ahead of her time in terms of causes that she believed in. So she supported family planning and birth control in the 30s, and she also supported AIDS research in the early 80s. She was a huge supporter of the arts, and so a lot of her money went to that. The Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, which now manages the all of the money that she managed throughout her life, continues to support those areas of research, including medical research.
And you're probably asking, so she died in 1993, mm-hmm. born in 1912, mm-hmm. right? So that's the span that we're looking at. An interesting time to be a woman, when a woman's role when she was born was far more limited than it was by the time she died. And I wonder if she saw herself on the forefront or felt at all constrained by the limits that one would place on a woman and what one expected of an heiress.
Well, it's interesting because before the archives were donated to Duke University a few years ago, I think that the narrative about Doris Duke was based on limited information about her. She was fiercely private. She did not grant interviews. She did not incorrect information that was printed about her. And so she had a reputation as a bit of a recluse, perhaps a little bit ornery. But she, as I started getting into the archives, I realized that she had a very rich life that was really unconstrained by the expectations put on women, especially at the time. She, loved to go ocean swimming into her 70s. She learned how to surf from a Duke Kahanamoku, who was an Olympic gold medal winner. She really, it felt like she didn't really care what people thought about her, but she also didn't feel any sense to correct the narrative that was being written about her. Mm. So
she may have loved her privacy, but the press didn't and was especially interested in her love life.
Right. Right. So quite often when Doris Duke is written about, the tagline is that she was unlucky in love, that she had two failed marriages. Well, her father was married twice, too, but we never hear that Buck Duke was unlucky in love. There is definitely sort of an anti-feminist assessment of Doris Duke that comes up because she did not fit the traditional arc that I think that women especially and, wealthy women were expected to follow. So I think that people would write speculative things about her and they never got corrected. And so that became the dominant narrative.
You said that followed her even with this exhibit. Were you in Florida where that was the headline?
Right, about the Palm Beach Post. Doris Duke, unlucky in love, but smart collector.
But a smart collector. Is there any indication, and with us still is Deborah Pope, who's the executive director of Shangri-La. That exhibit opens tomorrow at the Nasher Museum, her collection of Islamic art, out of the house in Honolulu and on the road now in Durham. Deborah Pope, any sense that you had just from going through those artifacts that she wanted to be known as a collector, that this was something that she would like to be respected in the world of collectors?
I have to agree with Bridget that I really think Doris Duke didn't spend a lot of time thinking or caring about what people thought about her. She's passionate about her causes. She's passionate about the things she cares and loves about. But she's not spending any time thinking about her brand or thinking about public perception. However, she's very interested in the ultimate mission of the Doris Duke Foundation for Islamic Art, about providing educational opportunities about Islamic art and culture, and about providing scholars the opportunity to research the collection that, you know, during her lifetime wasn't accessible, wasn't out there in exhibition galleries or being published. And those are the two opportunities she opens up, you know, in her will.
And Bridget, by all accounts, she was passionate in those love affairs. They were deep passions of hers.
Yes, and she, you know, she did have very passionate love affairs with men, and there is correspondence in the archives, which I think would make anybody blush. It was really quite wonderful, but I think that she would run into situations with men who perhaps were a little bit daunted by that. One suitor who she was had an affair with during World War II said, you know, whoever marries the Duke becomes the Duchess. And it was a comment on the fact that her great wealth is going to change a relationship.
Well, her wealth or her spirit. I mean, I wonder how much of that, the mm-hmm. fact that she could be so open about her sexuality, and if she was that open and explicit, that could be intimidating for men as well, mm-hmm. particularly then.
Mm-hmm.
What about, and were there people who were close to her? Did she stay close to people throughout her life?
She did. Actually, there was a period of time where when Buck Duke was looking into hydroelectric power, he was one of the businessmen who helped found Myers Park in Charlotte. So they had a house in Myers Park, which is now an inn and mansion. And so
Myers Park.
Myers Park.
Yeah, well, we're talking about her passion, I think, and people who are close to her.
Right. So there was a group of little girls, the daughters of businessmen there, and they stayed close, some of them, throughout her life. And so there was one woman who, on her 80th birthday, got a truck full of fresh flowers that had been flown from Shangri-La to her. Also, Doris loved the common folk. And so there's a gentleman named Johnny Gomez, who she met the day she arrived in Hawaii. And he was a sort of a beach boy teaching tourists how to swim and surf at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel. Doris met him that first day, and over time he became sort of a gopher for her, introduced her to the local culture, and in time became somebody who was a confidant, somebody who worked at the estate, and lived there all his life. And in fact, he outlived her by a few years and died in a bedroom at the estate that she had set up for him and had provided for him after she died.
Oh, man, there's a reality TV show in that. She was very interested in physics and Hare Krishna, spirituality, these things. Were they lifelong interests? Did they come to her later in life? Tell us about those interests.
I think she embraced things as they interested her, and then she would immerse herself in these things. So in the 60s, she was into yoga. She was vegetarian for a while. She practiced meditation. You know, different things struck her at different times. So in the late 1950s, when she was living back in Newport, Rhode Island, at Rough Point, it became clear that Newport was in a state of decline. And so she founded the Newport Restoration Foundation to save these 18th and 19th century historical buildings. The foundation persists today. They've saved over 80 buildings. But she would research the paint colors that were used in the original homes. She would research what plants were used when the houses were built. She really got immersed in things as they interested her. So whether that was, you know, learning how to dance from Martha Graham or hanging out in Harlem jazz clubs, something caught her eye and her interest, and she pursued it.
That was true. Martha Graham, now, was that a teacher that her father got for her, or did she find Martha Graham?
She found Martha Graham.
Wow.
So that was another pattern for Doris. She would locate experts who could teach her about things. This was true with the 1938 trip she took to Persia. She worked with a man named Arthur Upham Pope, who was a leading expert, Western expert in Iranian art. He helped put together the itinerary, introduce her to government officials, cleared the way for their travel. So she found experts who could help her, but then she made it her own, and that was a pattern that she followed throughout her life.
Well, Deborah Pope, tell us about the construction and the design of Shangri-La. You mentioned it earlier, but was she active in sort of working with consultants to make sure, and was some form of authenticity important to her? It's an original work, I guess, so it doesn't have to look like anything, but what was she going for, and did she employ consultants and work with people closely?
Well, she hired an architect, Marion Sims Wyeth, who did most of his residential and commercial work in Palm Beach, Florida. So an American architect trained in Paris, did some work in the modernist style. And he had a supervising architect who was on the job throughout the run of the project, and she worked really closely with him. His name was Drew Baker, and he was the person who worked most closely with her on the kinds of things that make Shangri-La really unique, which is, you know, when she's traveling in Iran and she's photographing and filming these 17th century pavilions made under the rule of the Safavid dynasty, and she's like detailed photos and filming of the capitals and the mirrored column shafts and the bases and the stenciled painted ceilings. She's sending all this documentation, drawings, engravings, films to Drew Baker and saying, this is what I want in the patio. So he's the real facilitator almost between her and the architect in terms of integrating, you know, the Islamic content and the Islamic applied ornament that she wants to make this place really sing and make it really uniquely hers.
Very active along the way. Tell us about, and she adopted an adult woman later in life. Tell us about that, Bridget.
She did. One of the things that can be so infuriating about Doris is that she has some interesting and eclectic mix of friends. Doris had one child who was born premature, died, only lived a day. And I think later in life, as the story goes, I have not been able to verify this, that this woman who she met through doing some kind of Hare Krishna something insinuated herself into Doris's life, and Doris considered her a second daughter. Be that as it may, the adoption went through and later was rescinded. I think people came into Doris's life. Some of them stayed for a few weeks. Some of them stayed for a few years. I think Doris always struggled with loyalty and knowing who she could trust. But she did maintain a series of friendships and relationships that were deep and meaningful and loyal. And I think, again, exhibitions like the Shangri-La can help begin to tell the truer story of Doris away from the more sort of sensational and titillating parts of her life, because there definitely are some of those.
What happened to her fortune after she died?
She managed her money very closely through her various foundations. In her will, she stipulated that the money go back into these foundations. After her death, it took a few years to sort of streamline and organize things into what is now the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, which serves as the umbrella group for these other foundations and which manages the money. They've given out over $1 billion since it was founded in 1996. So it's a terrific foundation, and one that she was the architect of early on in her earliest iterations of her will.
And we will learn more about Doris Duke's life at the exhibit at the Nasher.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I want to thank you both for being on the program. Bridget Boer is associate editor of Duke Magazine and a Doris Duke researcher. And Deborah Pope is the executive director of Shangri-La. Doris Duke's Shangri-La, Architecture, Landscape, and Islamic Art opens tomorrow at the Nasher Museum of Art at Duke University. You can find out more at our website, wunc.org. And that's our program for today. Thank you for listening. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.